Right, welcome back everyone to another GMBN podcast. I am joined by none other than G Afferton. Hello G, how's it going, mate?
Hello mate, good to be here.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Now, I suppose probably not need much of an introduction, but let's do one anyway. Now, obviously, grew up, should we say, down south?
Yes, I'd say that's accurate. I'm intrigued to hear this introduction, actually. I'm looking forward to this.
Really? Okay, well, I'll keep it's the PG version. So, born down south, as I know, we kind of went to school together, didn't we?
Yeah, back in Wells. Yeah, back in Somerset.
I know, southwest side of country.
Yeah, quite. I'd say that was the start of all the mountain biking for me there, that area.
It was. Led you on to where you are now, should we say?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say the biggest, like, having a school right next to some dirt jumps where we could go out during lunchtime or like skip a few lessons and go and ride the BMX was like, for sure, probably the best opportunity I ever had when I was a kid.
Do you know what? Before we get too waylaid on this subject already, anyway, I found some funny videos from that a while ago. I'll try and dig them
out. Did you?
Yeah, but like for all you guys and girls listening out there, we went to school together, and then on the opposite side of the road of the school, we had some proper good dirt jumps, didn't we? And a good local scene.
Yeah, it was awesome. I moved there like when I was probably, I don't know, 16-ish, 15, and we just stumbled across these dirt jumps right next to the school that I was going to. And literally couldn't believe our eyes, you know. There was like a full-on riding scene, like amazing dirt jumps, people digging there every day. And I you know, we couldn't believe our luck.
No, it was amazing, wasn't it? And above the school, like, what, 5 minutes above the school, there was the little downhill tracks we had.
Yeah, yeah. Literally like 5 or 10 minute ride and you could get up to the downhill tracks, little kind of push up, build little tracks. Just as good as it gets when you're that age doing it kind of just for the crack. And for sure got me into the riding.
Yeah, it's pretty much the perfect catalyst for getting into mountain biking full time, if you like, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's quite an interesting example of, you know, you're a product of your environment. You know, there's no way I would be into riding and racing to the level I have been if I didn't have all that riding so close to me, and, you know, my brother there building stuff and all the lads that we would hang out with riding, because, you know, suddenly you've got, you know, is zero effort to go ride. It was literally like free wheel out of school, go to the dirt jumps or push up the hill, go riding. Every opportunity I had, I was on my bike, and you know, that I think that counts for a lot at that age.
100%, but I think you're bang on there, a product of your environment, because I suppose look at yourselves, you know, fortunately myself working for GMBN and Dan Stambridge, who went on to work for Mojo and was also raced World Cups and things like that. So, you know, all of us growing up with... Yeah, you know, we all grew up riding on our doorstep and all still involved and loving mountain biking now.
So that's pretty cool. Very true.
Yeah. Okay, but then from there, I remember this was a sad day when sick form came around, and I think it was about that time that you decided to make the move to Wales. Things got a bit serious, didn't they?
Yeah, it was about then. I remember going in, I remember being at school, and I remember not really having a plan and not really knowing what to do with myself. And I remember being like, well, I'll go to sick form just because all my friends are, you know, you were going, I probably just copied all the subjects that I was going to choose because I had no goals in life.
It's just what you're doing it, really.
I rolled into sick form on the first day, and it was like probably 2 hours into the first morning, I went to see my tutor or whatever, because I had some races coming up. I said, look, I need some time off. Is this okay? You know, I'm getting into the riding. It's working really well for me. I need this time off and this time off. And they said no. So at lunchtime on that first day of sick form, I went home. And that was it. That was sick form done for me.
two hours of my first morning.
Yeah. Mum said, why are you home? I said, look, it's not for me. I tried. I gave it my best. It didn't work out. I'm going to go riding.
Do you know what? I think that's a brave step though, mate. Like, because if you know, you know. Like, if you want to follow your passion, your career, if you like, and commit to it, then that's what you've got to do, isn't it?
Yeah, and at that stage, you know, it wasn't like I was at World Cups and had sponsors and had like a route. You know, me and Dan didn't have this kind of route planned out, right? We'll do this, this, and this with these guys. You know, we knew that we loved riding. We knew that we were massive fans of racing, and that's what we wanted to do. And we'd had, you know, okay level of you know, success at that stage, but it was still too early to kind of, you know, it was built off nothing other than the fact that we wanted to do it and we loved it. You know, there was no kind of, there was no other thought behind it other than we love riding, we love racing. That's all we want to do.
Well, to be fair, as in your own words, if you had absolutely no idea what you were doing at sixth form anyway, you were just there because you thought that's what you got to do, then you didn't really lose out as such.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think at that age, you have to go with what you're passionate about. You know, I could have forced myself into something else or like kind of just shoehorned myself into a different career. But, you know, I loved the racing. I lived it. I breathed it. You know, every moment we weren't riding, we were watching videos and, you know, watching all the kind of, you know, Steve Peat, Will Longdon, Rob Warner, all those boys racing World Cups and reading the magazines. And me and Athy were just, we were obsessed, you know, that. And I would use that word obsessed because it was literally every minute of the day, no distractions. You know, it could be any weather, we'd be out there riding and it was what we loved. And it wasn't really, you know, it was the obvious decision at that point to me.
So would you say then, you know, once that was done and the sort of the decision was to commit to riding and you moved up to Wales, which we'll get onto in a moment, was poor old Rach just literally dragged along for the ride? So she didn't get a say, as it were?
A little bit, but Rach was a funny one with the riding because she wasn't really ever into riding as such, you know. She was never really, like me and Dan spent every moment on the bikes just because we love bikes, but Rach never was really into the riding. It was more about the racing for her. Like she used to come along to the races when we raced BMX and hang out just because we were all going. And then after a while, she decided she'd like to have a go and she won her first race, you know, and decided she liked the feeling of winning and she liked the feeling of being better than the other girls. And, you know, that's what kind of started it for her. But, you know, she never really was into riding with us. It was all just about the racing for her. So she kind of got dragged along and pushed into it. But she quite early on, she decided she liked it and that she was pretty good at it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to have worked out all right for her.
Yeah, she's muddled by, isn't she?
She's hanging in there. She's hanging in there, bless her. You know, do what you can.
I've taught her everything she knows, though. So.
Oh wow, yeah. Okay, so you made the decision to move to Wales. Why Wales?
Well, I think it was a few factors. You know, we needed to move, and we were looking to move areas, and we knew by that point that Dan and I were big into the riding, and that was what we were going to do, and I think we wanted to be somewhere where we could do what we wanted. You know, we could build tracks, we could build stuff that we wanted to ride. We could have a bit of a yard in the back garden. We wanted to be in mountains and be in an area that was good for training. And, you know, that was a big jump, but it was exciting. Like we were stoked on it, and we were it was quite a novelty to be suddenly amongst mountains. You know, we would go out the door and, you know, Dan couldn't wait to get stuck into, you know, he was building tracks at a rate that like we couldn't ride them fast enough. You know, he built tracks that we never even got round to riding. He was building that many, you know, he was
happy as a pig in,
he
was having a good time. I remember coming up and there was a few ghetto barn skate parks. You remember those? Just bits of plywood poking up here, there and everywhere.
Yeah, literally every area that we could build something in, he did. And, you know, it was skate parks, dirt jumps, there was tracks on every mountain, there was little mini bike tracks in the yard. It was just, you know,
it's interesting that, like, actually, just if you think of it from those days, which would be what, 15 years ago, roughly, to now, not a lot has changed in the sense that Afi builds left, right, and center, and there's skate parks here, there, and everywhere, and dirt jumps and fields. They're just a little bit more legit than the sort of leftover bits of plywood in a random barn that it used to be.
Yeah, that's funny because me and Dan were talking about this the other day and we were saying the same thing. Like, I go up to the forest, you know, I go up to the W Bike Park, which, you know, we're lucky enough to own now.
Yeah.
And I think literally nothing has changed. You know, he's there every day. You know, the only thing that's changed is the machinery's got a bit bigger. You know, he's got a bigger area to work in. But yeah, he's still up there every day building stuff, testing stuff. You know, he's got this like gang around him of kids that have like come from nowhere and grown into like legit riders now. And, you know, there's just, it's just this constant ongoing sea of never ending tracks and skate parks and dirt jumps to ride, and Dan's just in the center of it all, creating it, you know, happy as ever.
It has literally just become a bit more legit than what it was back in the day. The passion and like the drive to do it all is still there. Like you said, it's just, I guess, you know, with a bit of, you know, success comes a bit extra cash and a more opportunity. So you just take it to a grander scale.
Yeah. And I'm quite impressed with Athi, the way he's manipulated everything to kind of work in this direction for him. You know, he's, whether it was inadvertently or not, you know, he's kind of shoehorned himself into this lifestyle that allows him to do exactly as he wants. You know, he gets up, he goes, you know, he's in the machine, he's digging, he'll be building tracks every single day. He'll go riding in between. He'll be out on his moto in the evenings. You know, he's created this very unique lifestyle for himself. That's meant he kind of, you know, he's living his own dream, which is, it's sick to see.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the most driven sort of people I know, I reckon, for sure.
Yeah, I'd say so. You know, it's amazing what, you know, he works so hard. It's like, it blows my mind. I'll go up to the bike park and he'll be like, "Oh, come see what you think of this." And he's built a new track, you know, not just built a few jumps on it. He's built an entire new track and down this, you know, 700 meter tall mountain. You know, it's incredible what he's doing up there. And, you know, it's sick that he's building such a scene and that he's kind of, you know, he's creating something long term here, you know?
Yeah, because it's interesting, actually, like the Hardline course is like the evolution of a course that has been there for a very long time, isn't it? Like when, I think it was something similar on the same hill when we started coming up when you were there in the early days, that Hardline track is essentially just the progression over the years, if you like.
Yeah, Hardline, the track on that mountain has been there a long time. Something I always have to point out is that Hardline is nothing to do with W Bike Park, and it's in a completely different area because, you know, we have a huge amount of people contacting us saying, "Oh, I'd love to come and ride W Bike Park, but I don't think I'm quite up to the level." And, you know, people don't realize that Hardline is a separate thing to it. But that whole area, it's all, you know, within half an hour of there, there's just tracks and tracks, and they have been for a long time. Yeah, it's really good.
Nice. So obviously, you moved up to Wales at an early age-ish, or fairly early age. You're all well settled in up there now. You don't live together, any of you do, but you all live fairly close.
Yeah, we live close, yeah. No, we don't live together, but not far at all. You know, we ride and hang out most days. So.
Nice.
I think me and Athi could be, we'd be fine living together now, but I think me and Rach living together would be pretty difficult. She'd be a hard one to live with. Her house is mental. She's got a pet sheep.
She says the same about you.
No, I'm chilled, but I stay at Rach's sometimes and like come down in the morning and there's like two cats sat on the table, like her dog just like running around in circles. She's got a pet lamb now which lives in the house and just like trots around inside. Like it's chaos.
like organized chaos going on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. No, it's good. You guys are obviously well settled. Like you said, you got W Bike Park. What sort of, who was the main driving force behind that? Was it a sort of project or a dream of Dan's, which you sort of were involved in, or is that a joint venture, should we say?
It was motivation-wise, it was Athi that was pushing it. You know, it was his kind of idea, as it normally is with you know, the bigger things that we do, you know, that the dynamic of how we all work together, Dan, Rach and I, and Brownie as well, you know, is that Athi tends to come up with the enormous, grand, ambitious ideas. You know, he might not know how we're going to get there. You know, he might not know the details and the small steps that will take us there, but he'll know that that is where he wants to be. And he'll just set off towards that goal. You know, he'll just start. And, you know, the bike park was a good example of that. You know, he found this incredible area and, you know, started building tracks on it. You know, it was still owned by someone else at that point. It was still, you know, a working forest that some other guy owned. And he started building tracks with the goal of having this bike park on it. You know, he hadn't even spoken to the guy about buying the forest or buying this enormous area at that point. You know, it's 650 acres, which is a massive area. And
yeah.
you know,
that is pretty nuts when you think about it, that you own a forest. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know, when Dan first suggested it to me, I was like, you know, impossible. How would we do that? You know, but Athi's got this incredible ability to not be put off by the small details that, you know, you or I might see and recognize as reasons why we can't do something. You know, Athi will just completely overlook those, which I think is, you know, it has its downfalls for sure, but I think it's an amazing skill to have, because, you know, it allows you, you know, it opens the world up to you. It allows you to have so much more opportunities, because you just, you know, Dan decided he wanted a bike park, and he decided he wanted it to be this scale, and he decided, you know, it was going to be enormous, and he was not going to take any kind of half measures with that. And he went for it.
He's not messing around there, is he? That's for sure.
Yeah. And it's incredible to see, you know, it's nuts. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So like, I mean, you and yourself and Rach are obviously still racing, you know, full time at the moment. Still busy with World Cups, off-season training, so on and so forth. So obviously having the bike park is, you know, firstly an amazing place to train and practice, and you can essentially build whatever tracks you want to practice on. But do you feel like, is your involvement in the park sort of, I know it's probably not to the same scale as Dan, because he's a man on a mission, but do you actually actively get involved in the sort of construction and the running of the park and things like that at the moment, or is racing still first and foremost?
No, we do definitely. Yeah, we do definitely. And, you know, as is the case with everything that we do, we're all involved and we're all hands on with it, and we're all there on the ground kind of making decisions, seeing how it works. And, you know, definitely Athi is more involved, and, you know, it's definitely his baby, but, you know, we're a big part of it, and we're there every other day, and we're all helping. You know, I'm up there building when there's time, and I'm up there working with him and the crew. And, you know, it was a joint decision recently that we decided, you know, we wanted to build, you know, as nice as it is just to have World Cup test tracks, you know, we decided we needed something more chilled. You know, Dan's just finished a new red route that they've put in there, which is, you know, one of the most fun things I've ever ridden. Just this super chilled, like fast burned flowing trail all the way top to bottom.
Nice.
You know, we decided we needed something like that to let people that weren't necessarily World Cup riders to come and ride there. And, you know, it's worked out really well, but yeah, we're all a big part of it.
That's awesome. Okay, well, let's rewind a little bit and go. We've sort of covered from where you began to where you are now, if you like, sort of living and training, things like that. But let's look at some of the teams you used to row for. Now, obviously, back in the day when you were at Somerset, it was the mighty Muddy Fox team.
Yes, the mighty. That was my first World Cup win, actually, on a Muddy Fox.
Yeah, I remember, man. I remember sort of Muddy Fox, where they were, and should we say where they are? But yeah. The mighty Muddy Fox team.
Yeah, I mean, it might have been an intensive Muddy Fox stickers on it, but I mean,
who's to say?
Hard to tell. I think it was a Muddy Fox.
Definitely, it had Muddy Fox stickers on it. It must have been.
Yeah.
So what? From there, obviously, that Animal got involved.
Yes.
Which is, mate, that's a big signing. That's a big signing.
Yeah, that was the first kind of sponsorship deal for us that was kind of a big deal. You know, we were winning British rounds and making a few kind of World Cup appearances at that point, but that was our first. You know, they were the first people that kind of took a bit of a punt with us and took a bit of a chance and kind of took us on board. And they kind of, I think they saw us as these kind of scruffy, grotty little mountain bike groms that were like, you know, not really sponsorship material, but I guess they recognized something in us that maybe down the line could be molded into something that was, you know, resembled some kind of
some sort of
sponsorship worth in there, you know. Yeah, but yeah. Which I
mold, you know, these little feral kids into something.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I remember the first time turning up on an Animal clothing photo shoot, and you know, I had a bag stuffed full of just these creased, dirty old clothes. And I remember them explaining to me, like, you've got to fold clothes up and look after them and turn up looking smart. And I remember thinking, you know, why? Why would I do that?
Literally never done that ever.
Yeah. And, I you know, they really did just have to kind of shape us into this kind of semi-presentable mountain bike sponsored athlete.
Yeah. So really, you would say that's like kind of the first big deal, if you like. Because obviously, you know, Animal... I don't really know what's going on with Animal like anymore, but like Animal are a big thing. Like,
yeah, know, they were a big thing.
You know, they have big riders. You know, obviously Martin Ashton was on there, you know, quite a few other guys.
Yeah, very big. And, you know, I get a huge amount of people messaging, you know, kids messaging now saying, look, how do I get sponsored? You know, it's their dream to ride professionally. So how do I get sponsored? How do I do this, this and this? And, you know, it's very hard to say how, but for me, that was the moment where it went from a bit of fun to kind of having someone take a bit of a chance on me. And I recognized that, you know, at the time, yeah, it was someone saying, you know, look, we believe in you. We're taking a bit of a chance here and putting their faith in me. And, you know, I recognized that for what it was. And you know, I appreciated that a lot. And it was definitely quite a big moment for me.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, I guess for both them and yourselves, it obviously paid off because Animal stuck with you for quite a while, you know, moved on to sort of Animal Giant and Animal Common South. So some, you know, some big deals, yeah, going down.
Yeah, it was there for a long time and it worked well. And, you know, they were really passionate about it. You know, it was Steve Kitchen that was the driving force behind that. You know, he was the main man behind that. It was his decision to kind of take us on board. And, you know, him along with his brother, Robin Kitchen, were,
yeah,
you know, completely, you know, fundamentally in getting us going and bringing us into the kind of the mountain bike world and showing us what it was and how it worked. And, you know, we stayed with them for a long time and yeah, they were amazing to be with and, you know, great guys to give us that much support.
Yeah, for sure. So would you like, so when did Brownie come on? So obviously, you know, for those that don't know, Dan Brown is like the Atherton team manager and has been for a fair while. When the Mighty Muddy Fox became Animal Muddy Fox, is that when sort of, like you said, deals started becoming a bit more legit and you needed sort of someone to help manage that?
Yeah, I think it was probably around the time we were with Giant, Animal Giant, Brownie came on board. And that was purely because, you know, up until then I'd been doing everything. You know, I'd been in charge of the kind of running, you know, admin side of the team, you know, contacting sponsors and all the stuff that goes with trying to run a little race team and get it, yeah, to the World Cups. And, you know, at that point we recognized, look, we need a bit of help with this, someone that knows what they're doing and, yeah, isn't just me.
I know like your dad was super passionate. I remember him like pushing both your bikes up the hills at times, and your mum was obviously very helpful. Like, did they help in the beginning? Like, you know, all parents help, don't they? But like, did they have much involvement with that side of things?
Yeah, massive. Yeah. And, you know, that's a big part of being successful as an athlete. I think your parents have to be willing to put in time. And like you say, dad was the one that would take us to all the races, you know, speak to sponsors, help us at, you know, pushing up and cleaning bikes and all the little extra details. You know, he was the one that would give up all the time and put that effort into to really kind of give us the best chance. And, yeah, you know, that was a massive boost for us for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Crazy. It takes a lot of commitment from like yourselves and parents and everyone involved, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the thing that stands out to me looking back at how it all worked out and how it all happened is how delicate it is and how many things have to fall into place. You know, there's a lot of luck and a lot of chance involved. You know, how many, yeah, things have to fall into place, how many, you know, you have to have the right people there, the right timing, the right kind of, you know, there's a lot of things that have to align for, you know, a career in sport to work out for you. You know, it's, yeah, when I look, sure, back at it, you think any one of those things could have changed and it possibly would have worked out a lot differently.
Very true, mate. Very true. Some wise words right there. Very true. All right. So let's move on then. So it went Animal Giant, Animal Common Sal. That was, I think, should we say around, I think Common Sal, like you were doing good. You were doing really, yeah, well then, weren't you, bud?
Yeah, Common Sal were awesome. They were a great sponsor to us, and you know the bikes were great. Max Common Sal is one of the greatest guys we've ever worked with. You know, he's so passionate about the racing, just a really, you know, really down to earth, hardworking, yeah, solid character. And you know, we would sit down with him. He'd be saying, "Right, how can we make these bikes faster?" You know, which is, as an athlete, you know, that's what you want to hear. You know, you don't want to hear someone saying, "Right, you know, what bike's going to sell the best." You don't want to hear, right, what bike's going to, you know, be the most efficient to manufacture. You want to hear someone say, how can we make this bike faster? And he did that. And, so, and we developed some great bikes with him.
So when you started racing for them, it was on, was it the Supreme, I believe, like the V1, the first version of it, Supreme?
Yeah, I think so. And that was early days for Commonsal. You know, they're not really broken into the downhill scene as such by that point.
Because you guys would have helped. So you sort of helped, because that was, take it from the first Supreme to the V2, if you like, the second version of it, which was a completely different design. And on that, do you get a world champs on that one?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I think you did. Yeah.
Yeah.
On that newer version.
Yeah, I'd say so. And, you know, the bikes were kind of groundbreaking in that era. You know, the length that we were going was quite new. The way the suspension working was quite new. You know, there's a lot what we were working towards then that I see kind of still flowing through current bike designs, you know. And I think, you know, I think working with Max that allowed us to really kind of not stumble upon that kind of way the bike works, but really kind of, you know, it was him and his engineers that kind of started working towards, you know, this whole new transition towards how a modern bike is.
So like giving you the freedom to develop and progress a bike, if you like, and, you know, not just take a current bike and just tweak it a little bit, because that first version to the second version, they weren't even similar, like they were completely different.
Yeah.
So you essentially helped, like, from the ground up, if you like. It wasn't just, oh, we'll tweak the head angle a bit or something.
Oh, no, for sure. It was literally everything. You know, we really did have that freedom to build what we wanted. And, you know, there was no limit there. There was no kind of, right, give us the head angle you want to change within these numbers or the BB height here. It was literally what's going to make you a better World Cup racer. And we changed everything. You know, we came up with some monstrosities that just didn't work. But at the same time, you know, We that allowed us to gradually kind of create this bike that is, you know, it was capable of winning World Cups and World Championships and we managed to. And
yeah, so it did.
Yeah, and Max was so good to work with, you know, he's a great guy.
Cool. And so from Commonsal, that is when you sort of, I suppose, branched out, should we say, and it became Atherton Racing. Animal were no more. That loving relationship came to an end. And sort of Atherton Racing was born, I suppose.
Yeah.
With the first iteration being GT Atherton Racing, if you like.
Yeah, and that was kind of, Atherton Racing came about because we were in a period then where, you know, we were all doing well. Dan, Rach and I were all having, you know, success in different fields. And we were starting to get more offers of people saying, G, come and join our team, or Rach, come and join our team, or Dan, come and join our team.
Ah, oh, trying to split you up.
And people were willing to put a bit more money in, you know, if they just took one of us, because, you know, they didn't want to take on three riders. But
yeah,
you know, we would have discussions at that point and say, look, I've had this offer. This is a legit, you know, this is a good offer. This is a lot of money. What do you think? And none of us wanted to leave, you know, none of us wanted to break up. I wanted to go to the races with Athy and with Rach, and we knew we wanted to stay together. And we said, look, we need to come up with our own thing. We need to do our own thing, and we can be with the people we want. We can write, we can stay together. We can be in charge of this a bit more. And that's how we created Atherton Racing.
Because I believe actually even a few years, should we say, could have been a fair few years before that, you actually... in talks with Honda a little bit, wasn't it? I remember sort of some phone calls you were saying with Honda.
Yeah, there was a lot of different offers kicking around, and they all seemed to rely on one of us leaving
as an individual. Yeah,
the team. Yeah, and
mate, that must have been tempting. Come on,
it wasn't, to be honest. You know,
no Honda.
At no point in my career was I ever tempted to break away from Athy and Rach and be on a different team.
Nice, man. Good work. That's some loyalty. I like to hear that.
And it was only purely because, you know, I knew that's why I enjoyed, and, you know, the money wasn't really much of a draw for me at that point, you know.
Yeah, sure. So Atherton Racing obviously then was set up with the first, you know, firstly with GT, and then moving on to Trek. To which you had success, obviously, on both bikes.
Yeah.
Did pretty well for yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, and I think by that point, you know, Atherton Racing had kind of, you know, it found its feet a little bit. It settled into, you know, what it was, what it kind of, because we started it not knowing what it was, you know, it was just a way of us, you know, having our own team, and it gradually grew and grew, and we took more people on, and it kind of settled into this kind of, well, whatever it is now. I'm still not really quite sure, but it's kind of. It found its feet and it became, yeah, you know, a success, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I suppose what it's become now is Atherton Racing as Atherton Bikes. So I think I think people might want to hear about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's it. But it's still a different entity, you know, it's still different people. Atherton Bikes kind of came about because of Atherton Racing, and that allowed us to start the other one, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so that's, yeah, an interesting point. So do you find, like, obviously over the years you guys have had loads of big deals with big companies, what sort of was the I suppose the beginning or the point at which you thought, let's make our own bike? Like, was, say, Trek coming to an end, and, you know, I don't say, was there not an offer that you wanted on the table, or you thought, right, we can, you know, we can do better than this, having our own bike would give us the freedom to, well, to make whatever we wanted?
I think a lot of it came about because of that feeling of, you know, when you join a new sponsor and start working with a new bike brand, you know, that it's very much, you know, you get a bike, you begin that process of, right, let's see what we can do. They obviously want to improve the bike, and then you kind of start that whole process, and you go through the you know, it's a lot of effort to do that and to create a bike and to create this kind of machine that you're happy with. And then, you know, if you change sponsors 3 years later, you start that again, and then you start that again, and then you start that again. And we've always talked about how cool it would be to be doing that, but doing it for ourselves and doing that, you know, putting all that effort in and all that kind of work for us rather than, you know, another company. And it was something we'd always talked about and always discussed. And, you know, it was another one of Athy's kind of grand ideas. But there was never really a way to do it. And there was never really a kind of a path to get there, if you like, or any kind of possible way that would allow us to do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, like I sort of touched on it, you know, yourself and Rach are still, well, full-time racers. You're still on the World Cups. You're still going at it, you know, full tilt. Afi's obviously fully immersed in W Woods somewhere. He's buried doing something, no doubt, with a shovel and an. So actually having the time to start up, develop, manufacture your own bikes that's got to be fairly daunting.
Yeah, it was. And not only daunting, but impossible, you know, when it came to me, to Dan, Rach and I doing it, because there wasn't really a way for it to happen. It's another... You know, I talked earlier about how many things had to align and fall into place for us to allow us to become, you know, the races we were having. It was very similar with the bike company. You know, it was,
yeah,
we knew we wanted to do it, and we knew we had this idea about doing it, but it wasn't until a few things started to fall into place that it kind of gathered enough momentum for us to take it seriously and think, right, this could be an option. You know, it was meeting. It was meeting the right people. It was meeting the kind of, it allowing yourself to kind of see the steps that you had to take for it to happen. And it wasn't until that kind of started to work out and a few of those things fell into place that we thought, right, this might actually be, you know, a serious thing for us to do.
Yeah, because we're not exactly talking, you know, Afi in a barn with a welder. We're talking some pretty clever, you know, engineering feats going on, you know, carbon tubing, 3D printed titanium lugs, you know, bonded together. It's pretty smart stuff.
Yeah, for sure. The you know, there were a few things that we knew, although we didn't know how we wanted to do it, we knew we didn't want to just buy a frame from Asia and put our name on it. And we knew wanted to create something high quality enough to be able to race World Cups on. And they were the two main things. So we knew we had to fit somewhere in the middle of those. It was the technology when we met up with the guys, the engineers at Atherton Bikes, you know, Ben Farmer, Rob Gow, Ed Haythornthwaite, those guys were the kind of the catalyst for it. You know, we met them, they talked us through the technology, they showed us what they'd done in the past, they talked us through kind of how we could create this World Cup bike. You know, they talked us through the technology of additive manufacturing and 3D printing, you know, of creating a bike from titanium and carbon. And, you know, it's impressive stuff, you know. And the first time you hear about all this stuff, it's this barrage of information, you know, that they're explaining to you. And
I bet.
I remember coming away from that first meeting and thinking, like, you know, I recognized how excited I was. I recognized, like, how, you know, I was buzzing for this. You know, it wasn't like sitting down and going through another meeting with a sponsor, talking about how much they could pay you and, you know, coming out umming and ahhing for a bit. You know, I left that first meeting with those guys absolutely, you know, we were all excited. And I could see it in Dan and Rach and Brownie. They were all kind of, they had this, you know, when you talk to someone that they're passionate about, they had this fire in them. And, you know, it was pretty exciting for these things to start to fall into place. But there was a definite moment where we were on a kind of a one way or the other kind of decision time. And that was a scary moment, you know, that moment where we had to say, right, we're going to go for Atherton bikes. And we had to, and it was a jump, you know, it really was a big jump. It wasn't just kind of test it and see how it goes type thing. You know, we had to really throw ourselves into it.
Yeah, because I suppose there's not really just the, you know, you say throwing yourself into it. It's not really just from a riding sense, you know, developing a bike completely from scratch. You know, you guys have been on like race proven bikes forever. So you then got to make your own bike, get it up to World Cup pace, but you know, it's a business venture at the same time. So there's obviously, you know, a financial aspect to it as well. So you're making a commitment from that side of things. It's not just we got to make a bike and race it. You know, it's making a business work as well.
Yeah, for sure. And that was the scary thing. You know, it was a lot of, there were a lot of moving parts to it. Like you say, you know, it had to work in our minds as a, you know, as a business venture. You know, we wanted to create bikes and sell bikes, and you know, we wanted to build bikes that we would have wanted to ride at different stages of our careers. You know, we wanted to make bikes that we were happy with and give other people the opportunity to ride them. You know, as well as that, we wanted to create a bike that, like you say, was World Cup capable. And not only that, you know, we had months to do it in. We didn't have 2 years to develop a bike. We didn't have, you know, an infinite amount of time to create this thing. You know, the World Cup calendar starts on this date no matter what. And we knew that, you know, that was a constant ticking clock. Just we were creeping towards it. And to create a bike from scratch is a monstrous task.
Yeah, too right. I suppose the benefit of obviously the additive manufacturing of sort of making the lugs, I was reading, is that you, obviously the tubing stays the same to a degree, like you can change the length of it or whatever. But whereas with a fully carbon bike, you obviously got to adapt the mold, or, you know, make a new mold, change the mold for every time you do an angle change or something like that. You don't have to do that on yours.
The additive manufacturing gives you a huge amount of freedom. You know, you can, that's one of the things that drew us to it. It allows you to respond to changes really well. So for a race team, it does work well. You know, if we want to play with geometry or sizing or anything else, you know, we can do. And then on the bikes that we're manufacturing for customers as well, it's the same thing. You know, we get a lot of people calling up saying, look, you know, I want this bike, but I, for whatever reason, you know, whether it's the size of them or the type of riding they're doing, they want a slight change in the geometry. And that's easy to do. You know, it's as simple as altering numbers on a CAD file and punching it in. And, you know, that's
just like that, eh?
it's a combination of that technology as well as the engineers, you know, the caliber of engineers we're working with that allowed us to do it so quickly. It took a lot of work to get a bike to that standard so quickly. But, you know, it's the technology is incredible. That additive manufacturing is, you know, it blows my mind what the guys can do, the quality of it, the strength of it, that, you know, it's the first time in our careers that the race team has gone through the entire race season without breaking any bikes. Start to finish.
That's a Yeah, that's a good testament in itself, isn't it? Do you think you could have? Do you think you could have made a, if you'd have gone down sort of the all carbon route, wherever that may have been made, Asia, whatever? Do you think you could have developed a bike as quickly?
No, absolutely not.
No, you don't think, like, say you got, we'll call it V1, first one, first, you know, Atherton bike, downhill bike. You test it for a month or however long you guys test it for. I mean, I don't know the exact turnaround, but say you say, right, I want a, you know, a degree slack at head angle, top tube needs to be a bit longer. You wouldn't have been able to turn a frame around in as quick a time?
No, I don't think so. You know, the bigger companies that have the kind of the more of a sway over the kind of the manufacturing in Asia could do it quite quickly. But, you know, the testing is relatively quick. You know, I can ride a bike for a day and know that I need the top tube longer, the BB a bit lower, the suspension platform's not working right. You know, the rear end's a bit short. You know, I can give the feedback in no time at all. But to get another bike made, to make those changes, to get that bike shipped to you, and then to test it and then decide that it's still not right. You know, I can't remember how many versions it took us from zero to World Cup, but, you know, it was quite a few. And the technology allowed that to happen in a way that, you know, we were comfortable with, and we couldn't possibly have done that just, you know, buying a bike off of a shelf from Asia.
And would you say you're at the stage now then? So your second, you know, this would have been second year racing them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you say that you were, you know, whatever bike or version you're riding now is pretty much there, or do you still make changes even now? I mean, I'm not saying over whatever the production one might be, but for your personal one, or are you still tweaking, making changes all the time?
Yeah. We are still making changes. You know, I think as a World Cup racer, you're constantly making changes. And, you know, that was quite a, you know, That was a good example of how, you know, been involved with Atherton bikes, I had to kind of take off my World Cup racer hat and put on, you know, more of a, you know, someone involved with a brand point of view. Because I, you know, if you're creating a bike to give to customers, it's in my nature to constantly refine it and improve it and make it better. But there was a point where we had to say, right, this is good. This is, people are happy with this, you know. Let's get these bikes out to some people. And, yeah, you know, the first customers that had the bikes, the feedback was incredible. You know, the contact we had from them was immediate. You know, this bike's, they loved it. They loved the suspension platform. They loved how it worked. They loved the kind of what we'd done. And, you know, as a World Cup racer, you're constantly like, right, I'd like to change this. I'd like to improve that. I'd like to improve this. And, you know, the bikes that we manufacture are an ongoing process, you know, even from the first one we sold to the ones we're currently on, there's been small changes, but I think there will be a constant improvement. You know, there has to be, but you can't do it to the level you do as a World Cup racer. Otherwise, you will never finish something, you know?
No, and, you know, don't say a lot of people aren't going to ride a bike the same way that you are going to push a bike to its limit, but it's got to be a pretty satisfying feeling, you know, seeing that thing from start to sort of going out the door, shipping to customers and getting that nice feedback. That's got to be pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. You know, starting the Atherton bikes thing, there was a few key points that kind of were quite, you know, important moments for us. You know, that very first day when we made the announcement and kind of showed everyone what we were doing, you know, the feedback and the kind of response we got to that was incredible. That was quite an important moment for us all because, you know, it was such an unknown. You know, that the first feedback we had from the first customers was a huge moment for us because, you know, I knew the bike was good and I'd ridden it for months and months and I knew what it was capable of. But until someone else kind of, you almost need another person to ride it to kind of verify that and to give you that confidence that other people love it. And, you know, when I heard that how happy they were with it, that was quite a big moment for me.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, so, you know, we've touched on, you've had a lot of sponsors over the years to where you are now, but I suppose the one that's remained the most constant is the one that gives you wings. Red Bull,
yeah.
Yeah, you've been with them. How many years have you been with those guys now?
It's a few, quite a few.
That's got to be the longest serving sponsor for you, for sure.
Yeah, we've been with them a long time and they've been, you know, they've been good to work with. It's.
I was going to say, what was it like that day that sort of Red Bull sent you the old carrier pigeon letter saying, ERG, would you like to rock one of our lovely helmets? You were like, oh, yeah, that's pretty nice. That's worth thinking about.
Yeah, I remember being excited about it. You know, I remember talking to those guys. It was a bit of a slow, a slow thing to happen. They were, you know, they made contact and went to a few events with me, and we kind of hung out a little bit. And I think they wanted to gauge, you know, well, not just my capabilities on a bike, but kind of what kind of person you are. That's quite important to Red Bull, because, you know, they work with you for a long time, and they want to make sure they're kind of, that you're going to fit the brand well, and you're going to work with them well. And I guess to start with, they were kind of scoping me out for a bit to see if, you know.
Was it to see if Animal had developed you from that sort of scrawny, scruffy kid into something a bit more refined?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I guess so. But
you could thank Animal for that one.
I think they were on the fence about it. And then I had some success. I was second at that Red Bull Rampage quite early on. And I think that kind of sealed the deal for me. And they signed that me after helped. That. But yeah, it was, yeah. They've been.
So when was that? Like 03, 04?
Maybe 2006, I think.
Was it a bit later?
Yeah.
It's still a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time. Yeah. But, you know, they've been amazing. It's been sick to work with them. And, you know, I owe those guys a lot.
A lot of cool opportunities sort of opened up, I can imagine.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. They're a good bunch of guys as well, you know.
Nice. All right. Well, look, I think we need to venture away from bikes a moment and talk rallying. What was all that about, bud? Is that still a thing?
Yeah, it was just a bit of fun, you know. I just enjoyed it. And, you know, I think when you live in Wales, there's endless fire roads, there's endless opportunities for it. So, yeah, it was a good crack. And, you know, I'm a big rally fan. I love to get in a car when I can. And, yeah, it's good fun.
Do you, I mean, like the, you know, you did a few races. You were in Rally GB, which is pretty sick, actually, when you think about it. That's bonkers. Do you have a car? Do you have a rally? I mean, do you have, you know, if you've got a rally
no,
car?
No, I sold the car fairly recently, actually. I hadn't been in it for a while, but yeah, I haven't been to a race for a while either.
No? God. I remember us rallying it through the lanes back in the day, and I think, oh, geez. At least the roads are closed now.
Yeah, good training, huh?
Something like that, yeah. But, I mean, would you, other, you know, famous size Vullions, he jumped in the rally car and did pretty good. Is that kind of something you consider when mountain biking maybe winds its way down a little bit?
Well, I think, all the races from mountain biking, you know, you just love speed, don't you? You love that competitive side. You love going fast. You love that adrenaline that you get from pushing some kind of machine to its limits, whether it's a rally car, motocross bike, your downhill bike, you know, it's,
yeah.
But yeah, I think for me, it's two wheels, you know, it always has been. And I think it always will be, to be honest, but you know, that doesn't stop you trying other things, I guess.
No. I mean, we're the same age and both been riding for a long time. Admittedly, I don't do World Cups or nothing, but sometimes
still need a painter.
I'll make a late comeback.
Yeah.
What I was going to say was, you kind of, when it's all bikes all the time, it does, you don't get tired of it, but sometimes you just need that, we call it like a bit of an escape or a bit of relief, or just to mix it up. So I guess was that what rallying was, would you say?
I think so. I guess, I don't know. I guess I've always had this, I've always had, you know, I think I'm quite a calculated person, and I think the risks I take are, you know, I always try to, you know, weigh them up. But at the same time, I do think I'm quite a risk taker. I think I would describe my character as, you know, I do find myself taking a lot of risks that I view as perfectly normal things, and other people might question whether that's the case, you know. And I think it's just, you know, you explore these different things just to see how much fun they are.
All right, you've just sort of provided me with a perfect transition there. So my next question is, you sort of saying calculated risks. Now, over the years, you've had some pretty hectic crashes. I'll be honest, bud, one of my favourites is your snow crash in Teens.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was, I would say, a greatly miscalculated risk coming in at about 40,000 mile an hour.
Yeah, the calculations were off there. I was going a little quick, I admit that. Yeah.
I'd say, I mean, if anyone out there's not seen it, just give it a little search on YouTube. You can't miss it. Just put, I don't know, G snow crash or something and you send it to the moon.
Yeah, but I was fine. You know, I hurt myself, but I wasn't too bad. And I think that all my crashes over the years have been, you know, I've had some big ones, but it's normally the, you know, I've normally got away with the injuries from the big ones. It's always been the smaller ones that have tripped me up a bit more, you know.
Yeah, see, I mean, mate, you have had some wild crashes. A couple of from Rampage, I remember.
Yeah, there's some big ones. But I've always had this, like, I've always been quite open to taking risks with things, and always had quite a kind of a streak in me that's fine to try something and try. That's fine with, you know, putting myself in harm's way, I guess. And I guess I don't know whether I choose to do that or whether I just don't notice it happening, but it does seem to happen a lot.
It's a, you know, it's a sport we're involved in where I think you can't avoid crashing. It's an inevitable part, an inevitable part of it.
Yeah,
it's not if, it's when, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, we've talked about this before with Athi and Rach, and you know, would we have still taken the career we would have we have if someone had showed us all the crashes we were going to have? You know, if someone had sat you down on the first day of riding and said, look, this is what's going to happen to you over the years, would you still do it? I think we probably would have.
Yeah, because look at all the sick times you've had as well.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, don't you, like, you know, hey, all the doors, all the doors have opened. Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think I'd have changed nothing from riding.
The other thing we've always asked, after that question is, would you prefer to have all of your crashes back to back in one go and get them out of the way, or spread them out over your 15-year career?
Wow, that's a good question. That is a really good question. Well, what was your answer?
It would be like 24 hours of massive crashes, just like all lined up, like one after the other.
Does that include all the recovery time? Just like, what, 2 years of recovering or something?
Yeah, that's it. I don't know. I think I'd probably choose to spread them out a bit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think if I was in your shoes, I think I'd spread them out as well, to be honest, mate.
I don't know if I would have taken them all in one go. I think I've averaged two or three big concussions pretty much every year for the last 15 years.
Yeah, I don't know if we'd be having this conversation in quite the same way, would we, otherwise?
Yeah, I think I need that time to recover in between.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you for joining me on the GMBM podcast, mate. It's been a pleasure to chat to you and have a little delve inside the life of G Atherton there.
Oh, you're very welcome, mate. I enjoyed it. Anytime.
Yeah, good. Cool. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast. Just click the link and we'll catch up with you next time. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, guys.